You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Practice Show. My name is Kirk Barron. I'm your host, and I am so excited you're here today. This is going to be one of my favorite episodes of all time, and I'll tell you why in just a second. Now, as you already noticed, we're shooting this show live on Facebook, and we watched the metrics. The COVID conference was an incredible blessing and challenge in the same respect, and we got to know a lot of young dentists and dental students. And so if you're here for the first time and you're a new practitioner, I want to do two things. I just want to welcome you to an incredible community where there's no egos here. We're just all here to learn together, and you're going to learn a lot today. And then secondly, I want to encourage you to subscribe. So I don't care if you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever. If you're just listening on your phone right now, just go down to the subscribe button, hit that little subscribe button, because you'll see every single week we're going to bring you a brand new expert to give you some insight and some tips and best practices so you can create a better practice and better life. And I just don't want you to miss that. Also, we take a lot of show notes here. So as you're going to see everything I'm going to talk with John and Kevin about, I'm going to make this the craziest, easiest learning you've ever had in your life. So as you're listening to the podcast, if it's on your phone, just swipe up to the notes and click right on the link. So everything we talk about today, I'm going to have my writers put together the links, and they'll be right there and just make this super easy for you. Also, for those of you that are not members of the private Facebook group, I'm just going to encourage you to join us over there. I didn't even know how this worked. I don't even know how private Facebook works, but we started it during the COVID conference, and it's become an incredible support group. A lot of people asking about funding, just other questions. There's over 13,000 people over there. Just show up and you'll see, you'll feel very supported in that whole process. Now, I want to introduce my guests. I have two guests. I actually have a co-host, Dr. Kevin Groth, which a lot of you know. And our guest today, we're going to turn the microphone on our guest, who has not only been an incredible mentor, incredible friend, just a great teacher. You're an incredible husband, incredible father. There's so many things I do love about you. And I want to start with a story. And the story is this. I've told this story many times, but I love this story. In 2005, I had a friend of mine come to me. He's like, dude, you got to go check out this Cranham guy. And I'm like, I don't know. Like, no, he's your jam. Like, you would totally love this guy. And I'm like, I don't even know what. So I was like, well, he's not speaking anywhere. I mean, the closest place he's speaking is Traverse City, Michigan. So I was like, all right, I'm in Kansas City. It's a short little flight. I'll fly up there. I'm like, well, I'm going to fly all the way up there. I want to meet the guy or at least have breakfast. I'm not just flying up there free. And he was doing something that was a little cutting edge. It was the cosmetic occlusal connection. I'm like, well, that's risky in itself. So I got to hear this. And so I got your email address because I stole it. And then I was emailing him going, hey, I'm coming up. Hey, you know, I've heard about you. Let's be friends. And then somewhere along the way, you were like, I'll decide if we're going to be friends.
It's so smart.
I did the classic stalking thing, Kevin. You can appreciate it. I get there like 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and it's at this event center. And Damon Adams, if you remember him, he was there. Like, and I was like the first person to get in there. I think I got there before you. And like when you were setting up, I was
it's like 10 below zero. It was so
I remember that. And you're like, oh, stalker, dude, go sit over there. Like, oh, hey, say hi. And during that day, what we're going to be talking about today is it was incredible. Number one, I took a lot of notes. It was a powerful day for me in education. Number two, I didn't know what was coming next, but you told the story that we're going to be talking about today. And I told Kevin this. I heard that story in person and I wept. I cried so hard. I don't think I've ever cried like that in a seminar. And I cried to the point where I couldn't even like look up and I was weeping. And that story wasn't a short one. I mean, it went on for 20 or 30 minutes. And I remember looking around the room and we were all bawling together, but it was a story of courage, hope. I mean, some of the things that you have been through were mind-blowing. We're going to talk about that today. And it was about your son, Cornell. Mm-hmm. And I'll couple this with a couple years later, I go to the Dawson, you know, retreat that you invite. And I met Cornell and he is everything you describe, like just love. He's just a ball of love. That's all I can, like, he's just full of love. And today we're going to be talking about the Cornell effect. Your book goes live today. I'm so excited you're here. And Kevin, why don't you introduce our guest? Anything you would add on top of that?
I mean, I've only known John for like 2-3 months virtually. So I've never met him in person. I've never heard the Cornell story in person, but I've heard the legacy and the legend of this kid Cornell and the great influence it had on your life, John. And you've literally had that ripple effect throughout the community by telling and sharing his life. And I can't wait to dive into the story because I read it and it's just an amazing, amazing book. And I've gone through the roller coaster emotions the last couple of days just thinking about it. And I couldn't stop talking about it to all my patients and family today. So let's dive in, John.
I just want to say first, just thanks for having me. And you know, this has been, Cornell's 28 years old now. And so this is something that I started to think about what was sort of transpiring maybe when he was about 4 and starting to journal and taking notes. And so this has kind of been a 20-year process. At one point, it was a 200,000 word book. It ended up being about a 49,000 word book. And so I'm pleased with it. And it's fun for me because I do think it's amazing, but of all the things that I've taught, and I've been teaching occlusion, aesthetics, and restorative dentistry for 20 years, but I do think this has had the biggest impact because when I run into dentists that have heard me speak, they're not saying, you know, how's that bilateral thing going on? They're going, how's Cornell? Like, what's he doing? You know, and they'll tell me a story of how it changed how they think a little bit. And so this was something I felt like I had to do. I didn't have a choice. I was gifted with this and I had to tell the story in a way. And of course, Pete Dawson leaned on me. He just was relentless and in his persistence and bugging me. So I wish he could have seen it. He saw pieces of it, but I have a feeling he's aware.
Yeah. Now, all of us have been blessed with amazing wives. I met your wife and she's a huge part of this story. And I'd love for you to not only tell parts of the story, but the why behind the story. Like, you guys felt it was important to tell the story. And John, you just lead it. Kevin, go ahead and jump in. But I'd love to start anywhere you want to start with this.
Sure. Yeah, I think a great way to start is just why, you know, and tell you a little bit about Cornell. He was born 3.5 months premature in 1992. He had a twin. He was addicted to crack cocaine. And was at the Children's Hospital, the King's Daughters in Norfolk. He was abandoned there. His sister, his twin, was a little bit bigger, did a little better, went home with their biologic family. And he spent 6 months in that NICU. He was on a ventilator and trached and G-tube, and he got moved to a unit that was a vent-dependent unit at KD at the Children's Hospital that it's a little bit like a hospice. I mean, a lot of those kids don't leave there. And at that time, my wife was an occupational therapist there. And we were in a part of our life where we were trying to have a family really hard. It was a fun time of life. But nothing was happening. You know, we weren't having kids and anything. And so a couple of years went by and we finally got pregnant. And then about the time that Cornell was moved there was when we thought we were going to have a child. And in the midst of all that, had a miscarriage And so there was this kind of connection Kim had developed with Cornell. He was, it gets weird because a lot of the doctors didn't see it, but she felt there was more going on with him than a lot of people did. And along the way, at about 10, 11, 12 months old, he started to take breaths over his ventilator, which he wasn't supposed to do. And he was, you know, which is a celebratory thing for the for this unit because it's a chance of getting better. But then he was going to get moved to a home for profoundly retarded kids, and because there wasn't parental involvement. And that's when Kim, in her mind, thought that perhaps the reason we had our miscarriage was we were supposed to bring this kid home. And so she approached me with that idea, and I was very much against it at first. I just thought it was kind of crazy. And anyway, kind of weeks went by, and there's a story in there about when we finally made the decision. I don't want to give that up. But so we ended up deciding to bring this kid home originally as a foster child. And it should be noted that, you know, when we were doing that training to learn to take his trach and G-tube and all that, it was a couple month training. And on the day that we were bringing him home, and, you know, they sat us down and told us, you know, half these kids that go home with trachs and stuff don't make it, and that he was never going to walk, and he was never going to talk, and he was never probably really going to love us. And so that when we got kind of tired of this charade, that we, you know, they would come and we could put him in an appropriate place. And then to add to complexity, right before we brought him home, we found out we were pregnant again. So we went from, you know, bringing this high-tech kid home. Kim was 3 months pregnant, and that's kind of where it all begins. And so what's transpired was just a relentless, especially the first 4 years, just a relentless, it was a tough time. I mean, just, you know, so many medical procedures, some near-death experiences, some really tough stuff. But in the midst of all this was just this kid that just had this joy about him and this ability to kind of separate out the bad stuff and find magic in the moment that just kind of warmed your heart. It just pulled you in and wanted to make you pull for him. And, you know, so for me personally, that was kind of at that point in my career where I was studying with Dr. Dawson. I was doing some classes at the Pankey Institute, and I just realized that so many of the things I was upset about and stressed about was just baloney. It just wasn't even, and it was kind of, it was affecting me, you know. And the other thing I sort of realized was that part of the joy that I saw from my son was that he was just fighting 100%. Like he, nothing came easy, right? None of the neural pathways developed properly. So he was working with PTs every day and OT and speech and learning sign language because he had the trach and all these things. And he just had this spirit of joy about him. And I think for me, and this is, I mean, one of the messages of the book is I was a fairly gifted guy. I wasn't brilliant by any means, but I could kind of coast a little bit, still make a pretty good income and do the things that, that, you know, as a dentist does. And inside it was a little bit hollow. I say that I was kind of an 85%er and I could get by with that. But he shamed me into realizing that the gifts that I've been given are worthy of more effort. And I'm not saying I'm 100%er, but I certainly am not an 85%er anymore. And as a young dentist or as a young professional, as a young person, going from 85 to 95 or 96 or 97% over the course of 20 years changes the trajectory of your whole life. You can't really understand that. And that's why I think writing the book now, looking back, helps me have context to that, because it totally changed everything. Not immediately, but slowly, gradually changed everything. And so I think when I look at him, that's one of the biggest lessons was just he had his back up against the wall. And if he didn't give 100%, he wouldn't have made it. In fact, that was one of the things that I got to know one of the the pulmonologist that met him right after he was born, and he became a patient and ended up reconstructing him. And so he would always come in and get, you know, updated on Cornell when he would come in for hygiene and stuff. And he was telling me a story, or I was telling him a story about Cornell one day, and he kind of chuckled and he goes, you know, I love hearing stories about these kids. And I go, these kids, I mean, you said the other kids are like this. And he goes, just the ones that make it. And he's kind of like, you know, you have to understand about these kids. The ones that make it are wired to do things that most people can't. And he said, but what's cool is if you pay attention to that, you can emulate some of that behavior and tap into it. And I think that's what our family did.
Yeah. That's powerful. I love that. Kevin, I know you got a couple questions and I've got a bunch too.
Yeah. I think, John, if you could just like highlight some of the principles or themes of the book that you would maybe elaborate on, because that was definitely one that had an influence on me, but are there more that you would really?
Yeah. The other big one that I think is all the way through the book, the biggest one is that comparison is the enemy of contentment.
Sure.
And I marvel. I mean, there's so many times throughout his life that I was putting the story in my head and kind of, you know, projecting it on what I thought the story is and was in his head. And it was just different. And I guess the best example of it is just when Caitlin was born, 6 months later, there was a year or two there where they were, you know, they were kind of like our little politically correct twins, our colorful twins there coming up. And, you know, we knew there was going to be a time when she would go past him. And she did, you know, she started developing past him. And he, of course, you know, overcame so many of these things, learned to drive and have a job and all those things as a young man. But it just took him so much longer than Caitlin and then even his younger sister, 3 years behind him, went past him. Sure. And so as a logical person, you would think that this would make you bitter and make you jealous and make you upset and all those things. And it just never happened. I mean, his biggest gift, and it's not because he's not cognitively aware. There's a powerful story in there about when she got into university, and, you know, I was really worried about him because she was getting letters and presents, and, you know, they were both seniors in high school, and university was not in his, you know, it just wasn't going to happen. And I remember sitting him down and trying to talk to him about it and basically, you know, and tell him it's okay to be sad. You know, I'm like, buddy, you know, it's okay. You know, if I said, what do you think about Caitlin go to Virginia Tech? He said, it's great. You know, great. Virginia Tech will go to Hokie games. It's going to be awesome. And okay, that's not quite what I want. And I was like, well, what about, you know, you? Well, Dad, I'm not going to go to college. I know that, but, you know, it's okay. Hey, if not going to college is not in your cards, it's okay to be sad about that. And you can talk to me about that. And he just looked at me and goes, would that help?
Like, I love that part.
Like, dude, I've gone past this like 20 years ago. Get over it. You know, I've got my own path and I'm happy for Caitlin. And so I think in this world right now, worry about young Dennis, and, you know, there's so many things with social media and Instagram and people posting things about where they are in their lives. And I think it's so easy if you're having a bad day to look at that. And half of it isn't even real. I mean, that's the other thing. You can be comparing yourself to that's not even what's real. And so I think you have to be in life. And it's really helped ground me to be totally comfortable with me thinking about where I want to go, what I want to do, what I want to be, husband wise, you know, dad wise, dentist wise, businessman wise, all that stuff, and be totally happy with that. And if somebody is making more money than me somewhere and lives in a better house, or they think they live in a better house, or they're dry, you know, it just doesn't matter, because it's got to be your path. And I think that's one of his biggest things that taught me to be content and happy. Is to, if I feel myself going down that road, and look, it's hard not to do it, right? Comparison is, it's what this country sort of is born by. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't strive to be our best. I'm not saying that, because he does. He's strived you know, he's worked to be his best person he can be. But you can work to, you can work towards being your best and not be bitter about what else somebody else is doing. And, I think it's a fine line. Yeah.
And
yeah.
That theme comes across so many times. I mean,
yeah, it's it's unbelievable.
Driving. I mean, everything that comes up is just something that he just doesn't have it. And it's crazy to me that this is something that you just, how could somebody go through this and not have those emotions?
Like I say, you know, we would, you know, we would have gone in the corner and had the pity party with them. But
entirely. Yes.
Now, Kevin, we're going to knock on you a little bit, John, because as I started reading this, I'm like, damn, this is really well written. Like, the writing is fantastic. And then I went back and read the introduction. He said, well, God's the true author. I'm like, well, that makes sense.
There you go.
I'm going to couple that because I know your faith is very important to you guys. And as much as you know, Cornell has been a blessing to you, I think you guys were a blessing to Cornell. Like, let's go back in the story because this just didn't happen. And you guys, like, you – Kim's had a long history of taking care of these people. I did not know the story about your sister. Like, that was like, so I think, like, I almost think God was preparing you for this and conditioning your heart so that when this came, it wasn't what you wanted. It wasn't the script you wanted. And I think of one word, resiliency. Like, was there ever a moment you sat up on the end of the bed and you're like, what did we just sign up for? Because I read the feeding thing last night too. And I'm like, oh my gosh, after a whole day of patience, and you raise your hand and you're like, I was not the best to, because he couldn't chew.
No, and he would gag and sound like he was dying. You know, it would take us an hour to get, you know, just almost a you know, quarter of an ounce in him. He'd fight the whole way. And yeah, you're right. I mean, I say that in the book. I mean, Kim was an OT. That was what she was trained to do. I would cave. I just would like get the feeding tube out and feed him. And, but you know, we all had our strengths. But no, there were a lot of moments like that. You know, there were a lot of moments where, you know, I questioned what we were doing. But one of the other, you know, the nights that changed it all for me, and this is another, I think, important lesson, is like walking the talk, you know. And I talk about that when you have a business and you're telling your employees about what we're going to do in the future, and this is the goal and this is what we're all going to do. And then, you know, if you as the leader veer from that, it's kind of giving permission to the team members that you're not really taking it seriously. And one of the things that happened to me was that the first year or so that we had him, he had, you know, the trach in and he had the G tube and all this. And, you know, we, again, we're told he'd never walk or talk, and Kim and nurses are all trying to teach him, you know, sign language. And then lo and behold, he starts signing. And I'm like, holy moly, you know, the lights, she was right. You know, the lights are on, and I'm getting a little closer to him. But you have to keep in mind, all this time the goal was to get him well enough that his biologic family may take him back, because they couldn't have handled all this stuff. He never would have made it. So that was kind of the original thing. Well, right before his second birthday, we found out that the airway above his trach had closed off, and we were going to have a surgery, that they were going to take him to the OR, put him to sleep, vertically splice his trach open, and then take cartilage from his ribs and graft a new piece of trachea in there. And then they had to nasally intubate him and keep him asleep for a week. Well, this is like an 11-hour surgery, and, you know, this is like 2 weeks before his second birthday. And so at that time when he went in there, he was really doing great. He's coming to life, funny, cracking himself up. He just had these freaking, like, eyes that just glowed. You know, I was smitten with this kid by this point. So now we start into this, and when they wake him up after a week, he's not the same. His eyes are like dead looking almost, you know, the shine is gone, and he's just would sit there and not do anything. And what we didn't know was his grafts were failing. And so on the night of his second birthday, and Kim had been in there a couple times too, he would get into these episodes of respiratory distress where he couldn't breathe. And he'd be pulling, and you could see all his ribs, and it's just horrifying, you know. And so when it would happen at home, we'd bag them and get them to the back to the hospital, and they bring them home, and it would happen again. And I didn't sleep for 7 weeks. There's still dentistry in people's mouths that happened during those 7 weeks, and I have no recollection of being any part of it. And thank God it went okay. But on a second birthday, that was another night that it changed my life, because he was fighting for his life, and it was the middle of the night. It was about 2 a.m, and I didn't think he was going to make it through the night. It was teaching hospital, and I'm with these residents, and I'm looking at his heart rate. His heart rate's over 200 beats a minute, and he's just, you know, trying to breathe. He can't breathe, and I can't remember exactly what I said, but I asked them not very politely to wake up a real doctor, and there was an F somewhere in that sentence. And so they ran off. And so there was this moment where it's just he and I, and I'm holding his hands and praying, and I'm thinking he's not going to make it. And if I'm honest with you, on that night, I gave him permission to go be with God. You know, it's like, it's too tough, and it's too big a hill, and, you know, it's time. And he took a big old breath and kind of let out his air, and I can remember sort of losing my peripheral vision. And the next thing you know, he was sort of looking at me, and he closed his eyes, and I feel like I'm going to faint. And then like 10 seconds later, his eyes pop open, very telling, looking away from me, you know, not looking at me anymore, because he knew I wasn't strong enough to handle what was going on. And he's fighting even harder, like fighting, you know. I'm just looking down at this kid and just like, that was when the whole 85% thing came in. I just knew that this kid's wired different, and I would have quit. It haunts me, but I would have quit. I would have not been able to handle that. But after that, I was all in. After that, I'm like, if this kid is this strong, I'll exhaust all resources to help him.
And, I love that. Yeah. I mean, just your honesty to it all too, that I just feel like you were so vulnerable in this book, and you said how you truly felt and experienced during the times. And I just so appreciate that, because there's a lot of people that would hide behind those words, right, and not admit that type of moment. And it rings such a true tone that we've all had those moments of weakness, and I don't know.
That's the real stuff though. It really is. Yeah. But that's the effect, you know, that's the effect. I mean, you get glimpses of people like that, that change you. That's one of the big messages though, that I'll tell you, is that I think about that a lot. If I have a staff meeting or something, and he pulled when you look through the book, it's amazing, because middle school, high school, all these times when we were just so worried he was going to get eaten up, and he just had the ability of making people pull for him.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah. Brought me to tears like 10 times. And one theme I really pulled away from, I guess a couple different themes, would be your relationship with your wife had to have been so strong and so solidified during this time that you guys had to be in such unison in order to make that work. But also the gifts that you gave him in terms of the lessons and how to cope and how to deal, to the point where then you just let him go and let him experience life with those tools. And he ended up coming back with gifts that were far beyond what you ever envisioned him to pull. I don't know if you can elaborate on that.
It was interesting, but I think the second or third chapter, we went and spoke to a child psychologist. He was really little. And we actually went there because it was 94 in Virginia, 1994 in Virginia. And he's, you know, starting to go off to school in a year. And, you know, he's an African-American kid in a white household. And we went there to kind of talk about race, you know, to talk about like, how do we have a biracial family? And, you know, when do we talk about adoption and all these things? And it sounds funny, but, you know, it's interesting, but kids in biracial families often don't know they're adopted, because they just think it's normal. It's their only their thing. And so anyway, we went through a bunch of things with her talking about race and all that stuff. And we got all done with it. And then the last thing she said to me was, you know, we haven't really talked about the thing that's going to be your biggest challenge. And we just sat there and we're like, what are you talking about? I mean, and she goes, well, the biggest challenge you're going to have is, she said, look at the hand this kid has been dealt. I mean, you know, addicted to drugs, and he's a little kid, and he's premature, and he's going to be small, and he's, you know, yes, he's an African American child in a white home, but he said the biggest thing is that he has all these medical issues, and what you have to teach him. And they said that this is the hard part, because we're all caring people and we don't want to be, you know, a son of a bitch or anything. But she said, you cannot treat this kid any different. She said, the sooner he learns that life isn't fair, the better off he's going to be.
It's brilliant.
And it stuck. And what's funny about it, I make a joke about it in the book, but it's true that our daughters had a way harder time with that basic concept than he did.
I love that part.
he totally got it, because it was his hand. But you're right, Kevin, we did keep reinforcing that from the standpoint of, you know, challenging him a little bit, but we didn't have to challenge him much, because he was so social. Mm-hmm. And so fearless in his ability to want to go do things that, but we didn't hold, you know, I think a lot of people in the same situation with a special need kid. Oh no, I don't want him to go there. I don't want him to be disappointed. I don't want him to go to prom. I don't
any
want
any kid.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
As a parent, you inspired me as a parent.
Yeah. You just,
a 2-year-old, you know, it's.
Now go back to this. I am going to ask you one story. Well, maybe a couple. Chapter 6. I was a boy. I had a bike. I knew how important that was. I raised 4 kids. I taught them how to ride a bike. I remember how important that day was. You had a boy, and Caitlin, that story, and you finished the chapter by saying this, Cornell had pushed Caitlin. Tell us what that meant.
Yeah, so this was not one of my best parenting moments, but this was one time that I underestimated him, and I was nervous about him getting hurt, you know, because you're right, you know, the whole bike thing, I just didn't know whether he had the coordination to do it. And I was looking back to the physical therapy and all the, how long it took him to do everything. So we had some good friends, still good friends. They have a place at Smith Mountain Lake right near us, and they had 4 kids, and the 2 older boys were, one was Cornell's age and one was a couple years younger. And they were just awesome with Cornell, didn't cut him any slack. You know, they're bigger and stronger, and they just pulled him along with them. And so one day I was at work, and Kim had been bugging me about taking the training wheels off and all this stuff. And I was at work just doing my thing. And lo and behold, Cam and Grayson came over and went into the garage and took the training wheels off the bike and just beat the crap out of myself. So all afternoon, you know, pushed him, and he's going into fences and trees and all sorts of stuff. And he just wouldn't stop and pick himself up and get back on the bike again in typical Cornell fashion. So by the time I got home about 5 o'clock, he was definitely bruised and had band-aids all over his body, but he was riding his bike all over the place. And so I'm, you know, again, totally excited for him and hugging him and everything. And I look over there, and there's Caitlin, who's 4, and she's just got her arms crossed and turning red. And she just comes over and grabs my hand and takes me into the garage. You know, she was going to learn. And so 2 hours later, they were both bike riders and had all the band-aids to prove it. It was a pretty cool day.
It's such an example of Cornell changing both your daughters and shaping them into the fine women that they are today.
Well, what was interesting. And you see that, you know, some of Caitlin's, chapter about Caitlin's guilt, you know, in high school. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny how as time's gone on with her, she talks very openly about the fact that just like my response of watching him do the things that she does, I mean, she, it pushed her too, you know, and she's not sure she would have gotten, she's a lot like me. She's not going to be the smartest kid in the class, but she can outwork anybody. And but you have to have that drive, and I think Cornell gave her a lot of that fuel for sure.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Behrendt is brought to you exclusively by ACT Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. ACT Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you're looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
Talk a little bit about race. I mean, race was a big one in that segment. I thought you'd really nailed it because that's such a touchy subject right now. And you have such a unique vantage point for having a biracial family with all that's going on nowadays. I thought that was just a perfect chapter in it. That's hard to do right now.
It's hard. Yeah. I think back to that meeting with the child psychologist, and, you know, she straight up looked at me all the way back then. You think about 1994, and she said, you know, you're never going to know what it's like to be a black man in America. Mm-hmm. You're not. And, you know, we didn't talk about white privilege, but that's what she was talking about. You know, she was talking about there's just different experiences here that everybody has. And she said, you know, so your job is going to have to be to love him. But at the same time, she said was, in the end, we all have to be, you know, we can have our causes, like we can have our causes that we want to speak out against. But in the end, the hand that we've been dealt is the hand that we've been dealt. And it's our responsibility to pick ourselves up and make the best of it. And that's what we have tried to do with him, is make him aware that he is not going to get the same. In certain situations, he's going to be looked at differently than I'm looked at. There just isn't any way around it. But at the same time, I don't want him to ever use that as a crutch. And I talk about Colin Powell and quoted his book, and I never forget that. And I stood in line for like 3 hours to get his book signed when Cornell was about 5. And there's a chapter in there about him coming south for the first time and having the experience of going to a restaurant and being sent out back to have the food because they wouldn't let him in the restaurant. And he'd never had that experience up north. But he says straight up, he said, I made a decision that day that I would never let another person make me feel that way about myself again. Hmm. Like the strength of that is just freaking unbelievable. And I see that in him though. I see that if you talk to Cornell, I don't think that he, I don't know. I can't put words and I don't know how he looks at all of this, but I do know this. I do know that we all have certain needs, black, white, pink, yellow, I don't care. And one of the things that in this country that we've got to figure out is we do have to figure out how to make it fairer for everybody. And I don't necessarily mean handouts or any of that stuff, but I'm talking about giving people opportunity to then have the ability to work hard and move forward. And I think what happens sometimes is there's just not the opportunity, and then that kills spirit. Yeah, and, sure. And that's, if you look at Cornell, if we've done anything for him, we've been able to put him in places where he's been able to work hard. And you know, there's that example of the social worker,
like, totally,
you know, sure, of him, like, give that money to somebody who needs it.
You don't have to tell this whole story. We talked about the physical fortitude, just the mental, like a big part of this book. You're like, oh my gosh, like physically just the challenges are overwhelming. And then you get to chapter 10, stepping up for Addison. And then you're like, oh my gosh.
Oh,
like,
God, that killed me.
We talk about physical fortitude, like all, like talk about the emotional component of what happened when he stepped up for Addison.
Yeah. So a little story. So he was, so he had his last major surgery, and that's the context is, when he was like 12, he had outgrown. He actually had to have the trachea reconstruction twice when he was 2 and then 3. And then he was about 13. He was outgrowing it, and his trachea was like an hourglass. And they had to go in there and kind of take out a section of his trachea and sew the two good ends together. Sounds easy, but scar tissue and vocal cords, and again, another 10-hour procedure. So the year later, he sailed through that, and a year later, my niece was born, Addison, and she had cystic fibrosis. And she, I think, is 14 now. And Brian and Amy, my in-laws, just nice jobs, but they're not ridiculously rich or anything. And we started to learn that there's some out-of-pocket cost associated with this disease for chest PT vests and all this kind of stuff. And so we're trying to think of a fundraiser. And so we're sitting there at dinner, kicking around and trying to explain to the kids about the disease. And, you know, and Cornell starts asking questions. And he's asking tough questions, like, you know, how do these kids die? And you know, and so we're talking about airway and GI stuff. And he's a little more intrigued, almost like psychically he's connected to this in a little different way. So he comes back about an hour later and he goes, I got an idea. And I'm talking to Caitlin about something and I'm sort of trying to blow him off. And I got an idea and talking to Kim, got an idea, and I'm not really paying much attention to him. And so he raises his voice, never raises his voice. Dad, I have an idea. You need to listen to me. And I look at him and he goes, so there's this guy on TV and he got something called sponsors and he's shooting baskets and he shoot like a lot of baskets, but he raised a lot of money. And I'm like, buddy, you don't really play basketball. We do a little bit. And he goes, no, but I hit golf balls. Maybe I could see how many drives I could hit in a day. Maybe we could do that. And I was just sitting there staring at him like, holy crap, because we haven't. We've been playing golf like fiends, you know. And so we ended up calling it Driving for a Cure. Kurt was involved. You could do 50 cents a ball. You could do a dollar a ball, or you could just write in an amount. Most people chose a dollar a ball because people didn't think that he'd probably hit 100 balls or something. So, yeah, August 29th, 2006, we go out to Cedar Point. We set up initially 500 golf balls. And he had to hit it 180 yards inside of a grid. And keep in mind, he's like 14 now. He weighs like 80 pounds. He's little. So 180 was a pop for him to hit it out there. And we tee up a ball at 7 o'clock in the morning. He hits the first one, this little draw, 210, right down the middle of the fairway. I turned to Kim and I'm like, this could get really interesting. Well, he had hit 1,000 in the grid by lunchtime. So just think about that. Full drives, one and another, you know. So take a break, he goes for a swim, has lunch, comes back, and he hits balls all the way till 7 o'clock at night. He hit 1,638 golf balls into that grid.
Amazing.
He raised $64,000 that day.
That's wild.
Awesome. Yeah, that was like, you know, and that was one of the things, you know, it's like I'm laying there in bed that night thinking about if you'd gone back 13 years when we were going through all that stuff and you'd have said 13 years from now, Addison, you know, there's Brian's going to have a daughter, she's going to have cystic fibrosis, somebody's going to raise $64,000 in one day. It wouldn't even have been like remotely possible that it would have been him, you know, and we watched it. And watch it 12 hours, bam, 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 one after another. It's just like unbelievable. Blistered, bloody, you know, he'd come over to me, tape him back up, send him back in, you know. And the best part is because his math is not his strength, was like 10 to 7. He turns to me and he's just smoked. And he goes, have I made a difference? Like,
oh. God,
I'm like, dude, come here. You know, I could have been giving him an update. You know, I mean, he had no idea. You know, he just,
love it. I mean, what does he think of all this? Does he know the impact and magnitude that he's
I've been telling the story so long that, like, you know, when we have classes at Bayview and things like that, a lot of dentists are a little starstruck by him. It's kind of interesting watching him. Noemi, who is one of our really good dentists and is actually in my coaching group, you know, she was telling me that she came and did Drew Cobb's TMJ class at Bayview about a year ago. And, you know, he worked his way out onto the, you know, the patio and sat next to her, talked to her about her kids and told them about, you know, meeting Ariel, his twin. And, you know, they had this wonderful conversation. Of course, you know, she'd heard the story a couple times too, but just like you, Kirk, kind of came away with, there's a presence about him.
Yeah.
That,
I had the exact same, because I'd heard you tell a story. Then I go to the Dawson event. We're all out on the grass. I just met Lenny. And then here comes your beautiful family. And there's Cornell. Well, I know the story. So I don't know how to approach him. Like, I don't know if I should, you know, like, you always go in a little bit soft. And then he's like, in no time, he's like elbowing me. Like, hey, where? And then I saw him the next day. Where are you going? Like, I was like, he was like one of the guys.
Yeah.
So
if there's anything that God gave him, is he just loves people, you know? And so especially in middle school and high school, his ability to like befriend these coaches and get invited on teams. I mean, it's just like unbelievable, you know? We didn't have anything to do with that. Like, we had nothing to do with that.
That's not true. I feel like you had.
We weren't making the calls. That's correct. Not, I mean, yeah. We weren't like pulling strings. I mean, he was the ringmaster. Like in middle school, they called him the mayor. You know, it's funny.
That was my key takeaway as a parent, was just you gave him the tools that just let him go and be himself. And he found his niche, as scary as it is to let go and let him go to middle school, let him go to junior prom and figure out his place on the football team.
There's one more takeaway that I would maybe say tonight is that I think is huge, is he embraces obstacles in a way that I get emotional talking about it, but he embraces his obstacles as his biggest gift. It sounds crazy, but he just does, you know. And I think sometimes it's really hard in this world to see past when it just the shit hits the fan and everything is going sideways, that what there's going to be on the other side of it. And I just think that with him, so much bad stuff happened to him so early that I just think it's innate in him to know there's something next.
Right. I want to ask you exactly about that, because when I read this, I'm like, this book is not over. This is just the first chapter. Tell us what the future chapters look like for this amazing kid.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I just, it's one of those things that I think one of his biggest gifts too is he just sort of enjoys today. You know, I mean, I think he has goals and dreams like the rest of us, but he doesn't let goals and dreams stop him from living today. And I need that. Like, I'm a driven person, and it's very easy for me to, you know, it's one of those things is that I think he again has something, some innate ability to understand that. And so when things are sideways with him, you don't really see his demeanor change. I will say one of the coolest things that happened a couple years ago is he reunited with his twin.
Sure.
Which is later in the book. And that's, you know, that could have gone so many ways, and they talk every day and they see each other once a week, and he's got a little niece that he's so close to. And so I'm just going to sit back and watch, man. I mean, he's heavily involved in my dental office and does a lot of the digital stuff for me, their digital mountings, and he's learning more and more about that. But we'll see. He's still lives with us, saving some money to be able to go off on his own. So I think that's probably the next chapter. But I think wherever Cornell goes, he's going to have effect on people. And I think the other thing that I wonder, because I watch people walk by him, like if we're places or airports or whatever, and I see people walk by him, and they have no idea who they just walked by. I mean, what I mean by that is it's easy to not notice him. And so what I think about is, who do I walk by? Right? Who do I walk by that has wisdom and value? And is a person that I can learn from and aspire to be. I just think the world needs to do that a little bit more. It's just focus on people. And that's what he does. I mean, he just values everybody. And I think we can all, especially in this crazy world right now, we could learn a lot about that.
That's beautiful. Truly. I mean, I don't know. It changed my whole perspective on a lot of things. And I don't think a book has ever had that big of an impact on me.
Wow.
And I mean, that's honest. Honestly,
well, just imagine living with that every day.
I couldn't. Yeah. Knowing you living through these positions, I don't know how you did it. But you developed this kid that has made such a ripple effect on the community in dentistry, but also now is going to go far beyond this because I'm getting this book for everybody I know. And it's just going to be so cool to see their responses and reactions. I can't wait to share.
Well, I hope lots of people read it. I think for anybody that wants to be inspired and anybody that wants to read, you know, a hell of a story, but come away with it with some good life principles from a person that you would not expect to learn it from. This is it. And it's a story that has to be told. So I'm so glad. I'm so excited. I've worked on it so long. And for today, to be on sale and lots of people are buying it, it's cool.
Yeah. It's great.
Well, we're so grateful. And you know, like I said, this is only the beginning of this story, I think. And so, John, for the benefit of people listening on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever, where can they get the book? How do I get a copy? Where do I go?
It's real easy. So if you go on Amazon or Kindle or Apple, any of those things, the name of the book is The Cornell Effect, A Family's Journey Towards Happiness, Fulfillment, and Peace. And just click on it and get it. And again, you'll probably be able to read it in 2.5-3 hours, Kurt, about 6 hours.
But, I was telling these guys, I don't read very well. So my wife to me at night, I'm like, oh, honey, go back. Wait, what'd you say? Like, so it's incredible. So
probably the best thing, but the easiest read I've had. So, I mean, I don't know.
Well, I'm glad I shortened it because the 200,000 word version was terrible. So I had to slash it. But I think every chapter makes the point about the effect that he had on
entirely.
It is excellent. It is excellent. So cool. I don't want to keep you. I know we all have families to get back to. I was telling Kevin, my wife is making homemade chicken soup
tonight. Oh,
I got to get home so I don't get in trouble. But John, as always, Kevin, I love you guys. This is so much fun. And this is an important one because we're talking about something that's extra important. More important than dentistry. It's powerful. So I'm just going to encourage you, if you're listening, make sure you get a copy of The Cornell Effect. You'll absolutely love it. You'll love this, John. My aunt in Florida texted me. She's like, I already ordered it. And I'm like, I just posted it yesterday. I'm sure I'm going to get a full book report from my aunt here pretty soon.
We're getting some professional people giving us 5 stars. So that's really cool too.
No surprise whatsoever. Yeah. Truly.
That's awesome. Well, stick around while we say goodbye to everybody else. Thank you guys for tuning in to the Best Practices Show. If you enjoyed today, which I know you did, just do us a favor, hit the share button, share this with your friends, get a copy of The Cornell Effect. Keep sending us suggestions for things that you guys want to see. And until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show. You guys have a great evening. There you have it. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Best Practices Show. I hope you sure did enjoy it. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. We are always here for you. And if you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts. And if you really enjoy it, you can leave a comment or a 4 or 5 star review. But until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show.